Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So, continuing my series of AWE past and present, today's interview is with Caitlin Kraus that I did this year at Augmented World Expo. So the previous conversation with Caitlin was from 2019 at Oculus Connect 6. And then since then, Caitlin has continued to work in digital well-being to do these different types of immersive experiences, experiential design. She's a writer and teaching some of these different courses. And so she started teaching at Stanford. And then a lot of those lessons learned got turned into this book that's called Digital Wellbeing, Empowering Connection with Wonder and Imagination in the Age of AI. The book was actually released September 24th, 2024, and published by Wiley. So I haven't had a chance to read it yet, and I didn't have a chance to read it before our conversation here at AWE, but I just wanted to get a sense of some of the things that she was thinking about, some of the different points that she really wanted to cover. And we go into some aspects of the book. Also, there was a bit of me, I'd say, I was sort of in the state of preparing for my debate on AI, where I was going to be arguing against AI at the end of the week. And so when I'm in that phase of preparing for like a battle, then I'm gathering different information or kind of testing out different ideas. But I don't really have a good sense of what all the different other topics that Caitlin is talking about in artificial intelligence. And so sometimes when I go back and listen to conversations that I've done in the past, that sometimes I'm like, just ask the questions, Kent, stop going on these different rants. Well, I know at least I'm thinking about it. I don't know if other people as they're listening to me are thinking that as well. Sometimes I get onto a toot on different topics. And so it's interesting for me to go back in time and listen to whatever those topics that were kind of triggering me into like different mind streams. But anyway, Caitlin is kind of looking at digital well-being, which I think is a topic that we all need some ways of managing our relationship to technology. And I think there's a lot of interesting research and advice that she's exploring within the context of this book. And there's actually a demo that I saw after this conversation that she was in collaboration with Jason Marsh and what he's been working with in Flow Immersive, and having this kind of like mix of quantified self and different data that you're recording and having new ways of exploring that type of data. So finding ways of using the spatial affordances of the technology to gain new insights around what's happening inside of your mind and your body. And what's also fascinating about this conversation is that Caitlin goes a little bit into like this kind of immersive, mindful experience that she had, this kind of like mindful flash mob that was like walking throughout Augmented World Expo. So because it was more of an engaged, immersed experience, there's going to be stuff like that that doesn't likely have like a video recording of for the archive. But just interesting to hear a little bit more around how she kind of had people joining into this mindful flash mob that she was leading there at Augmented World Expo. So anyway, yeah, lots of really fascinating corners that Caitlin is looking into, both her practice as a writer, as a practitioner, as a teacher, educator. Yeah, and just kind of all tying together into this concept of digital well-being that we're covering here in today's episode of Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Caitlin happened on Wednesday, June 11th, 2025 at Augmented World Expo in Long Beach, California. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
I'm Caitlin Kraus. I'm founder of MindWise, and MindWise is an interactive XR and also physical platform. And gosh, it's 10 years old. So I've started that company back in 2015 when I was living in Switzerland and moving back to the US. I'm telling you the long version because I was an educator for over a decade before that, full-time, middle school, high school. And so that led me into being curious about learning theory and also tech applications that don't denude our sense of presence and well-being and creativity. So fast forward, and right now I teach a course at Stanford. I'm a lecturer in the wellness department. The course is digital well-being. And I also have that company, MindWise, where I get to involve myself in all kinds of creative projects. And I self-identify as a writer. I've written 6 books, 3 books of poetry and fiction, and 3 books of nonfiction. So the whole time that I've been working in the field and developing all of these programs and applications, I've had that parallel side of wanting to make sure the integrity of the research is in line. So that deeper dive has led me into the writing world. I think it's useful to let you know, Kent, that I'm also what you might call an ambivert. I'm deeply introverted sometimes about my studio space and my work, And then people who see me, say, at conferences or social gatherings will see me as an extrovert, where I get a lot of energy out of that social interaction and relationships.
Okay. And maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into the space.
Yeah. So my grandfather worked for NASA, and I like to start with that because he had applications in the ultrasonics universe. And as a kid, I thought that was really exciting. My background was with parents in the Foreign Service. We moved around constantly, and so we were in different countries, different environments, where there were all kinds of different cultures and languages and political situations. So when I was a little kid, my go-to was curiosity. If I didn't get curious, I remember feeling like I would get nervous and scared and quiet, so I kind of leaned into noticing, making up stories, and curiosity. So couple that with my grandfather, who was working in a lab doing all kinds of experiments, and I grew up just loving that idea of losing yourself in tinkering and in play and in creative reverie. So we didn't have a television when I was little. I would do a lot with puppet theater and dance and music. And yeah, growing up, I'd say if the question is about my path, is that what it's about? Yeah. I think sometimes as a kid, there's that impulse to belong. And for me, it was also an impulse not to join one social group or one clique, because I would see people kind of choosing their groups. And I always felt like, oh, I'm interested in everything, and I don't want to be exclusive about friendships. So that was coupled with, for me, being very emotionally, if somebody was getting teased or bullied, I remember feeling when I was little like it was happening to me. I wanted to stand up for them, protect them. So I've always had a strong sense of what might be considered social justice. I just don't have, I don't have an ability to watch things that are cruelty, and I do, and I try to combat that with kindness. So as I was growing up, I was definitely the person who was interested in creating more social connection for people. I was a very competitive athlete who went to nationals in running. So I was a runner who competed in the mile and in cross country. And when I was doing long distance competitions, sometimes that was my time to learn more about resilience and about mindset and about how we can push past some of our barriers and also what it means to work as a team. Certainly in basketball and in some of the competitive sports I've done, I've learned a lot about how each person can contribute to something bigger together. Yeah.
And when did XR come onto your radar and be a part of your career journey?
So virtual reality and XR, I've always loved games and immersive games. I was a programmer out of college, and I grew up playing a lot of games. And when I was living overseas, teaching in the international school program in Zurich, I became friends with someone at Google who was developing Google's XR lab. So as that was happening, I had a vibe. I ended up just getting totally attracted to XR. That was about maybe 2015 into 2016. I loved all of the XR. At the time it was called, I was really more interested in virtual reality. And I would go into experiences and just feel myself in a state of wonder. And wonder and awe has always been a driving force for me. And I think some of the earlier experiences were like Into the Blue and an older program where you were inside of a asteroid and had to kind of find your way out through playing with these geospatial kind of shapes. And there was such an element of surprise and also agency coupled with me feeling a deep sense of peace and contemplative resonance that I was hooked. I was hooked in a way where I felt like I wanted to somehow make this a part of my life, a part of my business. I was already moving from education into founding my own company, MindWise. And I knew that my company was built on mindfulness, design, and storytelling. I didn't know what form it would take. and XR seemed like the perfect medium to guide people into experiences where they could step outside of their comfort zone and also feel safely encouraged.
Yeah, I know we had a conversation a number of years at Oculus Connect that I'm intending to go back and listen to that and push that out, because I think that was at the very beginnings of your journey, maybe a few years in. And now, fast forward to 2025, you've recently published a whole book on digital well-being. Maybe you could skip ahead to what you were talking about there, and then we can go back to like other ways that your career has kind of led you up to some of these deep insights.
First off, it's such a privilege to be able to talk with you about this and create that double layer, because I don't remember exactly what I said in 2019. And it's been, you know, it's been 5.5 years. And this was right before the pandemic. And I feel in general, like for me, the journey could be represented by a spiral. So each year or each season or each passage of whatever the cool phrase that's used in the media, whether it's metaverse or AI, you know, these things have a stack that's vertical where they all seem to interconnect and relate. And you're someone I value that sees beyond the hype, but also can connect the nodes. So back in 2019, I would have been talking about the three A's of mindfulness. I had just moved from Switzerland back to the U.S. I'd been working with a company called Limbix on what was then a VR application for digital therapeutics. And that was a spin out of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford. I was doing some great work with mindfulness and therapeutic application. And the three A's of mindfulness are something that I've used as a definition: awareness, and how we form a sense of advancement beyond perceived boundaries, and then that third A of authenticity. So I would have been talking with you about what mindfulness is and how we have a consciousness, and probably we went into a lot of talk about where our sense of presence is when we're in VR. I think that probably, well, there would have been the confluence right then. It was Oculus Connect, you know, about to be Meta Connect, about to have metaverse as a word coined. And now fast forward 5.5 years, and I've been thinking very deeply about digital well-being, you know, with the book that just came out, well-being not as a panacea, not as a prescription, but the idea that what if humans have a feeling that they're already enough and they're not missing something, they're complete. And this idea of human thriving in this age of AI is about seeing beyond the hype into what our humanity is really all about. And I think, ironically, we can create a lot of experiences using XR that bring us back into a real dignity of the layer stack that starts with embodiment and starts with our human form, and stripping away those compulsive layers of, oh, I have to follow this media, or I have to, you know, there's that quote by Charlie Munger: if you want to evaluate the outcome, look at the incentive. We've been incentivized in the past by engagement, which means that it's all dopamine spikes, attention grabs, loot boxes, you know, and a lot of digital well-being is meant to be an optimistic, agency-empowered book that says, hey, you know, there's a former version of media that's really maladaptive and actually kind of malicious, and there's a new form of media we can focus on and create that's more about medicinal media, wonder-driven media, media that people have a power to choose and not feel like they're, you know, I think in the past 10 years, there's been a lot of destructive repercussions of the way that different generations, especially the ones that I teach now at Stanford, you know, have been kind of just overwhelmed by tech and by the way that it's built. So this book is about reframing our connections and giving back hope and agency. And I can go into more detail about that. I feel strongly about it without getting rid of the creativity. Yeah.
Yeah, one follow-on, the title of the book, of Digital Wellbeing in an Age of AI, you talked a little bit around how we're living in this algorithmic reality where it is trying to capture our attention. And like you said, these like malicious entities that are not really thinking around the outcome of what our mental health might be or how it may be landing on us to be receiving all these messages or pressures, and that, you know, it's kind of on each of us to navigate this landscape of all these services that are capturing our data, gathering all this information, trying to create these psychographic models of us to constantly be pressuring us and persuading us into things that may or may not be in our best interest. And so curious to hear a little about your story of AI and how AI is kind of fitting into this current moment and how to achieve this state of digital well-being in the context of all these pressures to not cultivate that sense of well-being.
Yeah, and first off, naming that the pressures are real, because I think it takes a lot of trust right now to... I create experiences. I create spaces where people can come together and feel that sense of trust. Even as I wrote the book, I was thinking about who would be the readers coming to this, and not just the ones that say, oh, I love messages of mindfulness, but ones who might say, oh, that's interesting. I didn't think this book was for me, but maybe they read, like you said, the subtitle, Empowering Connection with Wonder and Imagination in the Age of AI. And they thought, oh, you know, these seem like they're paradoxes that we could have connection in an AI-driven world. So my deeper intention is that I follow something that I call the middle path, which is every time people try to strike some kind of binary or some sort of polarization, I'm like, oh, and how is there a yes and to both sides? And how can we find beyond the polars something that feels resonant and true? And this doesn't mean that I don't have strong opinions and strong views. What it means is that I'm existing, and so is everyone else, in moments that are emergent. And so AI right now is deeply emergent. People want to have easy answers, and it's a conflicting time when sometimes truth and science, you know, things are challenged, and that's happened in different periods in history. I think it also happened in the Renaissance when there were these great discoveries, and there's also that fear and that pushback. So I'm like you, very, very interested in philosophy and in humanity. And to answer you, right now that sense of trust is also coupling with a deep curiosity, I think, in humans to find out more about what is our sense of meaning and agency in a time period where everything is kind of being questioned. Traditional family structures are different. People can use AI to, you know, help them. And traditionally it's like, okay, this is disrupting work or disrupting the nature of how we feel secure about things like jobs. And yet it's also opening up a bigger question, kind of like holding up a mirror, about what makes a human. So if we're not combative and we're not saying, oh, AI is against us, because essentially we're creating the humanics underneath it. We're creating some of the ethics-driven principles that drive it. And I think you brought up the psychography. You know, and in XR environments, there's also the biometric psychography. So what I think right now is kind of laying out the groundwork and foundation is kind of necessary, kind of like forming a new language. How do we want to talk about AI beyond LLMs? You know, this is not LLM. I think there's a greater opportunity right now for people to talk about a 3D spatialized new way of being where data. I mean, it's kind of down to data. This is where well-being, I think, does relate, because it's really important to have human thriving. We can't thrive if we're in fear. It's very hard to go into a state of wonder if you don't feel safe. So if you don't understand where your data is or how it's owned, you know, then if you don't have a trust in place, this is where I think people will feel disenfranchised and lose their sense of power. Yeah, and there's a flip side. There's an emotion that I had wanted to talk about with you. So maybe you could ask me a little bit more, and I'll dig in more deeply to that, because it comes up in the book in the future state, and it has to do with my vision of collaboration over competition. Yeah.
When you say the emotion, what do you mean by that?
I mean that when I'm describing to you so much fear, I even feel in my body like, oh, well, what's the antidote? Like, what do we go into? Because it's not just me saying to you, oh, Kent, I'm not going to be in a state of fear. I'm going to be in a state of trust. It can't just be like flipping a switch. For me, what I'm talking about, and this is why there are so many interactive exercises in the book and why I'm also building a spatial garden that's interactive and co-present. One of the points that I would want to make is that we have one future that's possible where everybody has a personalized AI agent. They all go into Socratic learning models. You know, I've been studying learning theories and I consider myself, you know, someone who's a lifelong learner and also a teacher. So I get to play a lot. And these specialized AI models could lead people into belief systems that everything from therapeutic applications, which just got the highest ranking in future of AI, it was saying, oh, great for therapy. And yet there's a twist because it doesn't, in my mind, it doesn't replace the intimacy of a human to human and our mirror neurons and things that we have a sense for as human, physical, biological beings that we haven't quite, right now, we're proving it out. So if we go down a certain future path where everybody has specialized AI applications that create their own customized worlds, they kind of turn off to the co-present relationship building with other humans. And I think that's a narrowing and a siloing and an isolating. One of my deep commitments and my mission is to heal the loneliness crisis in the world. And it's very hard to do that and at the same time promote AI applications that would tell everybody that, you know, they have their own specialized, isolated, one-on-one encouragement. So I'm more interested in AI applications that would be emotionally resonant and maybe feedback some self-reflection and have some generative world kind of responses. So I've been working on that in what I'm building, where somebody would feel a sense of presence and wonder and be able to share in experiences with other people as a result, where they feel more connection and they feel a sense of encouragement and mattering. You know, how often do we feel like we belong during the day and we can be compassionate with ourselves instead of this high stakes, perfectionist, constant surveillance world that we seem to inhabit nowadays?
Yeah, I think that being here this year at AWE is probably one of the more surreal experiences, just because I do feel like that there is this kind of shifting of what feels to me like a new cycle, like a new beginning with smart glasses, like maybe as a new platform, but also with just how pervasive the AI is. And, you know, I feel like you mentioned earlier that you want to take a middle path. And I feel like I similarly try to, but I also want to entertain the polar opposite if the critical mass of one side is in a collective delusion. And so I want to create a dialectical opposition point just to balance the overall, just to facilitate a deeper dialogue around AI. Because I do feel like that we're in a moment from the political and to many different issues where there is an extreme polarization, where Richard Tarnas talks around how moments in time like this can be moments where each side sees the other as being a part of a diluted reality. And so maintaining some sense of what the truth is and people that don't believe that truth as a part of the delusion. And I feel like in AI, it is this kind of path of true believers who are surrendering their sovereignty over to AI, and then people who are almost on the end of AI abolitionists who are saying we should not use this because just the way it's produced in an unethical way, the data colonization, the way that it's using so many resources and it's not sustainable, it's doing it in a way that is not already in right relationship to the world around us. And on top of that is causing harm to marginalized communities and amplifying that harm. And so, you know, and this is largely around the large language models, which, you know, in reading Karen Howe's The Empire of AI, using empire as a metaphor for what AI is doing in terms of trying to consolidate this wealth and power, but also who's benefiting from the automation, who is suffering. So yeah, just like looking at all these different layers, I have more unease around the future of where this whole thing is going, because I see all these problems that people are just overlooking because they see short-term utility built on an ethical foundation that is made of sand in terms of how these things are kind of move fast and break things and not follow copyright law, not follow trust and safety guidelines, you know, one of the points that Karen Howell is making is that large language models is a system that can rely upon huge amounts of data and scale up in GPUs and get some sort of perceived utility when more symbolic AI or other approaches that would take more time or more money to develop, that those that would actually potentially be more accurate in contrast to the hallucinations that we're seeing. So I feel like, yes, I understand the middle path, but I also sometimes find myself falling more on the AI abolitionist side. Let's send all this stuff into the sun until we can like get it to a point where it's actually in right relationship and built in a sustainable manner. And also, yeah, I don't know, it just feels so rushed. And also, like, now the story is that, oh, in order for AR devices and XR devices to take off, we have to meld them with being the primary interface for all this AI. So yeah. I hear everything that you're saying in this middle path, but I also feel like, you know, like, oh, God.
No, and it's super frustrating. And I think some of what I'm introducing, and this is also kind of in the book at the beginning, there's this parable. I'm talking a little bit about Taoism in principle, and the vinegar tasters, you know, it's like the vinegar tastes like vinegar. Like right now it's good that we're frustrated, I guess, because I don't want to go into La La Land. And I think that's another misconception, like, oh, mindfulness. I get a lot of people asking, what about digital detox? Or let's just go into states of reverie where we can pretend our way out of this place of feeling angst. And I actually choose to name it and feel it. And a lot of what I've been doing, including in leadership applications, is going back to what it means to be a good listener and what it means to embody the qualities that we say are values. So when I talk about middle path, you know, it's partly related to some of the work of Chris Holmberg. Accountability is one example. I can hold a lot of other people accountable, and there's also this continuum of self-accountability, which doesn't mean perfection, but it's sort of, I think you mentioned the word sovereignty, and it's like, how do I choose for you to be free? Because our freedom is not in opposition. So sometimes I'm looking at it more in a spatial form and not as an axis, like sort of, how can I not be in denial or be deluded about all of the facets of considerations, and also hold space for naming when to step up. And there's so many metaphors, but I've been repeating that line from The Second Coming by William Butler Yeats, just saying, oh gosh, you know, the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity. Like sometimes I feel this passion coming from things that are just empty, attention grabbing applications, you know, and I'm somebody that loves to support great creativity, but it's like these amazing, well-meaning, you know, really people who stand as forces for good are kind of holding back and trying to develop something that's a really beautiful, perfect, kind of something creative that's going to help. And I say, let's also go for that. Like, let's not be messy and break things with our ethics, but let's put things out there that say, hey, this is a work in progress, but I stand for this. One of the other continuums is actually winning versus success. And for a long time in my pathway, I thought, oh, I work for mindfulness, well-being, wonder, come from an education background. You know, I'm learning that things can be broadly successful. What does it mean to win? It doesn't have to mean sacrificing your values in order to have other people reach and use what you've created and thrive with it. Do you know what I mean? Like, we come from maybe a culture where a lot of value is placed on quick monetary gain. And it's been an incredible past 2 years seeing how many people want to use AI and think that it has to mean choosing between their values and what they would call winning. And so I get very passionate myself about it because I just think right now is a time to kind of reframe for humanity, which is why the cover of the book, if people look at digital well-being, it's not a human hand and a robot arm. You know, that was one of the first suggestions for the cover. And I was thinking, no, we need more color and vibrancy and this idea of something that's fractal, not literal, more figurative. Because I think actually the answer, or one answer to all of these very serious, important questions, is to bring back some play, bring back some creativity and some of what we had as children, which was a sense of passion and wonder and trust. belief in love. So I talk about a lot of these traditionally softer words and terms because I really, really want people to hear from me that they are enough, that they belong, that they're loved, and there are places for them to source from deep within a sense of connection that bring them back into that co-presence with other people. And that's like XR and physical, where they can be creative sources for others too. And so I'm building those opportunities, whether it's in education or in something that's a spatial garden that I've built. And I'm grateful. Here we are at AWE, and I led a physical meets digital well-being walk yesterday, where I walked through the conference area and had 5 stops along the way. And at each stop, people joined in. People could see that there was an energy there. And one of the prompts was to walk as if your feet, you know, first we spatialized. We imagined ourselves as designers of 3D media. I had people look up because sometimes you don't look up. You're just looking out and programmed toward the next stop at the conference. And so we instead went into our body mechanics, like what's your sense of sound? How do you move? So we moved really gracefully against the floor. And people were told not to speak, and it was really funny. It was kind of like a mindful flash mob where we walked through the conference not speaking. Other people saw, other people got curious, and some other people joined in, not even knowing what the prompt was. They could follow along just seeing the other people responding to me. And other exercises were in partnerships. Other things were quiet. I had a guided meditation with poetry. And none of this was digital, but there are digital applications that come from that sensibility. So after that 45 minutes together, I had people coming up to me saying, now I'm refreshed. Now I put that energy back in. Now I feel like I'm showing up as my full human form to then take in all this great learning. So, you know, I have to share that because I think we've lived in the most awkward time to be human, where it's hunching over phones and it's 2D screens. And a lot of us here in the world of VR, AR, XR understand that there's a beyond and there's spatial forms that bring us back into connection the way we're meant to think and learn and be object oriented. And people sometimes just need that invitation. I want to give them that invitation to realign. And yeah, it's for me, that's the exciting proposition. How do we address all these problems right now with AI and everything else, and also do it in a way that invites everybody back into that, like, you can be part of the solution. You can be part of. You just sometimes need to fill your well, because overwhelm, anxiety is kind of everywhere right now.
That's beautiful. Yeah. It reminds me of like the work of Priya Parker, of the art of the gathering and finding new ways of gather. So I don't know if you've read that book or.
Yeah, I have. I love that book. Yeah, that's right at the heart of it. Mm-hmm.
Finding new ways that we can gather. It's a trend that I'm seeing on the festival circuit of having location-based entertainment where it is somehow cultivating some sort of emergent social dynamics by the invitation to have to step into a magic circle of an immersive experience.
Yeah, and that's a form of awe and wonder, that collective effervescence, that feeling of belonging. Yeah, and that fun of not being able to expect it. Like, it's kind of on the program, but it's also sort of adjacent. Yeah.
Yeah, I was a little curious of how did this course at Stanford come about of digital well-being? Was this something that you had been cultivating and pitching, or like what's the context of the department? And yeah, just curious to hear a little bit more like how you came to be at Stanford teaching some of this stuff to students there.
So little known fact about me is that I have an MFA in creative writing, storytelling, poetry. So a lot of these convergent moments will happen because of what I think is serendipity. But anyone like us who might look back on career, you can kind of see the parts of the map that were always connected and you just didn't know. The part of teaching at Stanford that really converged with that creative part was because I started to teach the teachers. I was invited in to do a digital workshop for people about how to create connection across digital divides. So again, this idea that digital would be separation for me was not ringing true, because I had built lots of worlds for connection and metaverses. And it was right before the pandemic when I led a workshop for educators about how to welcome people into a digital space and give them a sense of connection and belonging. So kind of like onboarding for Stanford, it was in a Zoom kind of atmosphere, but I was knowing there was also the layer of XR, and different departments just really resonated and said, this is great for us to learn. Now, they started using a lot of those techniques once the pandemic hit. And so around 2019, 2020, I was invited onto the team to teach in the Department of Medicine. So it's the wellness department. And I could design the course from scratch myself, which was awesome. So I got to focus on digital well-being. And for my life, I hadn't had a background in medicine. Well-being is a word where I'm always thinking about thriving. I would have maybe identified myself as a creative storyteller, like I said, a designer, somebody that has a personal practice in mindfulness. And as I started to apply and synthesize these ideas for other people, having spatialized media and XR be part of the equation became part of how I designed the course. So I love your question here because it way leads unto way, and it became kind of like what I say in the book is beads on a necklace. Each topic related to the other topics in the course. So the course at Stanford, the subtitle was Building Healthy Relationships with Technology. And so what I was teaching, and I'm still teaching, is that our relationship with tech is a double meaning where it's both how we feel and interact with our devices. That's also been part of the communications track at Stanford for many years. And we could talk more about that in that department as well. But the second meaning of it is relationships, human to human relationships, human to nature relationships that are mediated by technology. And I should say that humans are part of nature, but I mean the larger natural world, how we look at environment, you know, how we use technology not to distance ourselves from biological nature, but how we sometimes see it as the connector force. I designed the course. I brought in VR segments and XR segments, and students come in from all different disciplines because it's an elective. So I get students who are in the medical school, students who are in business school, and also undergrads, all applications.
Yeah, and I had a chance to see you do a brief presentation about some of your work on digital well-being at the Oregon Reality Lab. They had a group of advisors that were coming together and listening to different presentations. So there was a lot of frameworks that you had from thinking around this space, and I'm also a big fan of different types of frameworks. So it seems like you've done quite a wide range of different research for this work, and that you've got your own embodied experiences of working in virtual realms and holding different mindfulness events over a number of years. You've got facilitation of these groups, you've teaching the course. And so it seems like you went down quite a rabbit hole of research from lots of different domains, a very interdisciplinary approach of pulling from all sorts of different things. So just curious to hear a bit about your process of putting together this book and like how you start to map out the landscape of the literature and the research that you're drawing upon.
Thank you. This is a big question. So I want to create my own. It was so important to me to have the research, and the research evolves, but I needed to make sure that it's verified and that everything, I mean, I use a lot of research in what I do, and I consider myself a researcher. So the frameworks in the book apply to the best emotion research because there's been new findings, you know, for example, that our face doesn't always show emotion. I'm interested in neurodiversity, how people might have emotions and also have those emotions be couplings. So Lisa Feldman Barrett, for example, is a great emotion researcher, and she has a lot of different studies that have unveiled new findings. One of them is that we attach emotion to experiences sort of a nanosecond after beginning the action. And so if you drill down on that, I think one of the propositions for XR that can be so healing is that our brains are predictive, and we're predictive creatures that are cross-referencing all of our past experiences. And sometimes we are attaching emotion to an experience before we've actually had it. So it's kind of like we're priming ourselves for something that sometimes becomes our outcome because it's what we're looking for. And if we can create more experiences that widen our scope, kind of like eating from different palettes, and we can do that safely in XR, then people have more experiences that are positive to cross-reference with, so we can identify a better range of emotions that can have healing outcomes for people. So some of the research about emotion and the brain, in addition to debunking things like the triune brain theory, you know, lizard brain, these things sounded great to people earlier, and they became something that people coined and wanted to reference because it's catchy. But in the book, I talk about why those theories have been debunked and what current research is showing and how you can use all of that knowledge to really form better experience design. So this book is for people who are leaders, who are also creating experiences. So they could be creatives, they could be designers. I think everybody is a life designer. I wanted people to take that and do something really powerful with it. So the frameworks also talk about how we could go into experience design based on what I have as the four culture cornerstones, which also apply to media, of dignity, freedom, invention, and agency. So how people can look at everything. It could apply to game design. You know, how do you start with building in those values and those invitations for players and for people who are participating to feel a sense of meaning and belonging and welcoming. And then another framework that I really like that's useful because it's invitational, not prescriptive, are the 7 E's of immersive AI-enabled computing design. There are lots of words that start with the letter E, and I started to notice them, whether it was engagement, embodiment, experience, you know, and this all has to do with somatic principles and how we apply it to our XR layers. And so that's in the book, kind of broken down, how do these different words that all happen to start with the letter E, emotion and empathy included, you know, how do they add to our design considerations? One thing that I don't do in the book is give people like 10 steps to meaningful well-being that's a checkbox, because I do have people asking me, you know, what are some habitudes, you know, what are some digital well-being tips? I can give people behavior tips, but I don't want to create conditions that bring up an emotion of shame if people don't meet that expectation, because we're not cookie cutter creatures. Everybody's life is conditional and dynamic. And so chapter 2 is all about defining well-being, defining digital well-being, and putting it in a dynamic context where people can evaluate their own lifestyle and their own priorities, and then make some quality choices about how to approach digital well-being and what's worked. Because it's not that the device is the enemy. One thing I will say to everyone listening is sleep. Sleep has been one of the number one interesting factors that is so helpful and useful for humans. And there's not really a hack. Like, people might say, oh, can I have a lifestyle that's great and get 4 hours of sleep a night? And no science research has shown that people don't need sleep. We need good sleep. So, yeah, everyone needs to sleep.
Yeah, and so if we go back to 2007, that was the release of the iPhone. We're now 18 years from that, which if you look at the age of most college students, they're at least 18 years old. And so, you know, we're kind of at the point where a lot of the students coming into college these days have lived for either entirety or most of their life with an age where we're dealing with these little rectangle portals that allow us to escape and into all these other realms, but also to be addicted to everything and to have algorithms in our lives. And so I feel like there's probably at a point where as we start into maybe a new cycle going more and more into XR, maybe this will be an antidote to that type of dissociation from 2D realms, and that we can be more embodied, be more connected. But just curious to hear a little bit of vibe check of what's happening with students. They're coming into your course. What are you seeing in terms of like what kind of ecosystem, information ecosystem, and how are they negotiating their lives with all this technology?
Wow. Okay. So I'm going to generalize for the sake of the question, because I think I could say, oh, the middle path, can't, I've seen everything. And that's true. So all of this is generalization, but I've seen what we've identified and laughed at in class as FODA. This is post-pandemic. Fear of doing anything, or fear of dating again. So I've seen a lot of students, you know, and they're open. We have a whole section of the course about digital dignity and relationships and trust and dating. And dating means something different. You know, how did they negotiate that? And that also correlates with students wanting to have separate accounts. Like, their privacy matters so much. A lot of them think it's funny. They don't want to be influencers. They view, you know, they want to be an influence in the world, but the idea of the social media influencer, I've seen more people kind of rolling their eyes saying, my privacy matters more than anything else. And not because I don't trust, but because that's my power. Like, that's when I get to show up as an authentic human with other people in a physical space. And they have their digital applications, you know, they've been using AI, they're pretty savvy, but students will linger after class and some of them tell me, and I'm addicted to gaming. Or, and I'm here in this course, and you might have heard me at the first class say that I want to build an application, and I do, but I'm also suffering from anxiety, and I need more to fill my well again. So I've created, I mean, this is what I love, kind of based on what we talked about before, I've created a lot of intentional spaces for that kind of third space, I guess we would call it, where the sole focus is on the class itself forming a bond, or people being able to go into dyads, like two people just sharing, how was your day? What happened? Because then you come back to a topic of digital well-being and we can attend to what does it mean to be seen, to be heard, to be nourished. And yeah, and I think storytelling, you know, that we talk a lot about personas and about whether there are digital personas. Some of them are really wonderful, where students who are exploring some of the topics that relate to their identity, they can use XR and get really creative and playful and have different avatars. So it's very interesting to see what the next generation is valuing. And sometimes at the end of class, you know, I say this in terms of class, but you can imagine this could be an adult workshop as well for a company. But it's like we're talking about all these topics and then making them real for life. And then at the end, I said to them, you know, there was a time this last spring when all of the planets were visible, most of them, I think, maybe, and they were in alignment. And our class ended about sundown, early dusk. And I said, for the last 10 minutes of class, instead of doing our digital well-being meditation, let's go out and look at the stars. And the student said, we haven't done that ever on campus. You know, and we went out and, you know, there was a dark section in one of the quads and we just kind of laid there, looked up at the stars. They could see the planets in alignment. They were bonding. And it was so connected and meaningful. My biggest sense of happiness as a teacher was then leaving. That was the end of class, so we talked about what the next week would be, and then I watched them walk away and have all these micro conversations together as they were walking off. And I feel like that's something that's the value that you don't put into the syllabus. Like, what's the outcome of this course? You know, students will say, how can I achieve the best, you know, in this course? And it's like, well, You're going to know when you're achieving one of the goals of that class is that, you know, and I want to just take a chance right now to add something about suicide, because part of this book was me interviewing one of the top suicidologists in the U.S. She's also working with the U.S. military and younger generations and military, and lots of subsets have rising rates of suicide, and they've been about since that year 2007 that you mentioned. And it's the gravity and the levity. You know, there's so many opportunities for wonder, and it's very hard for a lot of people. And, you know, I feel so strongly that sometimes these topics become covered over and not talked about, and then they're seen as like the shadow side. And we need to bring more of those shadows into the light and say, hey, there are a lot of people that might not know how to ask for help, or, you know, well-being can be in many stages, including and before a crisis. And sometimes I think just the ability to name emotions and do more work with emotion, it might be a part of that healing. So I put all of that research into the book as well, because I wanted people to see the statistics and not have that covered over, and also see the integration of some of these topics with XR applications.
Awesome. And finally, what do you think is the ultimate potential of all these XR spatial computing immersive technologies and what they might be able to enable?
Well, I think as we run the gamut, you know, and I'm talking about from the serious to the sublime and everything in between, some of the capacities, I guess one thing last year that you noticed that was kind of a surprise for me is that one of my poems was commissioned by Ferryman Collective and put into their immersive storytelling VR theater production. And I didn't expect to be in Uncanny Alley, A New Day. And then when that was integrated, you know, again, the word integration, we can be scientists and artists. The future of XR, and it's very hopeful, because I found for myself as a poet, sometimes I would say, oh, that's my hobby. Okay, that's my hobby. But it can become part of your career path. You can integrate it. Anything that you love and feel passionate about, it is my hope that we will have more possible for us that's maybe not even identified as a career path right now, but having more freedom, having more creative agency, more connection. Again, it's based upon a lot of principles of cooperation. So I think sometimes our social systems are reframing right now to be able to make that possible. But this is the proposition. That's why it matters so much to talk about ethics and really identify what might not be working so that we can form better solutions, because we've never had a more creative, interconnected time in history. And so it's all there like puzzle pieces. That's the proposition, how people can be invited, you know, everyone invited to experience this. That's why for me, anytime people might say, oh, these topics are new to me, I'm like, yeah, you know, tell me more about you, and let's all discover how we can thrive together and be less separated and less antagonistic, as you pointed out. You know, if our quick impulse is toward, do you know anger and wonder? I think I might have mentioned this in 2019, we'll see, but anger and wonder fire at equal amplitude on opposite ends of a spectrum. So, you know, what can we do to not deny frustration, but convert it into something that can be equally active? And that's why I love to be in these interconnected systems where there are more people who are active as forces for good. So let's find each other.
Awesome. Anything else that's left inside that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
Thank you for asking. I'm building a spatial well-being experience that's all about play and wonder. So it's become something that is an immersive garden. And if people are curious, I would love for them to reach out to me, because there's so much right now happening and developing. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, Caitlin, it was a real pleasure to hear a lot more around digital well-being. I think we're all negotiating, you know, dealing with variety levels of stress and unease and uncertainty in our lives these days. So it was great to hear a lot more of your thinking around all these variety of different issues that are these universal experiences that we all go through. And so, yeah, looking forward to digging more into your book and to being able to dive into your digital well-being space of this garden. And does it have a name?
Right now, the name for it is Bright Now, because sometimes we're thinking about the future and in a state of worry, or we're ruminating about the past. But every time I say the phrase Bright Now, I remember the opportunity is actually right now to see the brightness all around us.
Beautiful. Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. So much fun. Thanks.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Voices of VR podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, then please do spread the word, tell your friends, and consider becoming a member of the Patreon. This is a part of podcast. And so I do rely upon donations from people like yourself in order to continue to bring this coverage. So you can become a member and donate today at patreon.com/voices of VR. Thanks for listening.